This episode is brought to you by Visit Williamsburg. In Williamsburg, Virginia, there's never too much of a good thing. Whether you're a foodie, a golfer, a history buff, a shopaholic, an outdoor enthusiast, or a thrill seeker, you'll find what you came for here and more. So ask yourself, what is it you want? Discover Williamsburg and plan your trip at visitwilliamsburg.com.
Hey, TrumpCast listeners, just a quick message before we start today's show. I wanted to let you know that starting the week of September 10th, we're going to be making some episodes of TrumpCast available only to members of Slate Plus. We've talked about Slate Plus here before. It's our membership program. Members are already receiving ad-free versions of TrumpCast and all Slate's other podcasts. But now, our members will be receiving every fourth episode of TrumpCast in its entirety. We love our advertisers, but we want more of our revenue to come from you, the people who listen to this show and care about it. We think that if you care about journalism, you should support it and help it thrive. And that's especially true with a show like this one that doesn't pull any punches. So again, starting the week of September 10th, every fourth episode of TrumpCast will be for Slate Plus members only. If you want to hear every episode of our show and you're not a Slate Plus member, sign up now at slate.com/TrumpCast Plus. It's just $35 for your first year, and you'll get no ads and more content from other Slate shows like Slow Burn and the Political Gab Fest. And of course, you'll be supporting the work we do at Slate every day. So don't miss out. Sign up now at slate.com/TrumpCast Plus. One more time, it's slate.com/TrumpCast Plus. And now let's get to the show.
He is playing a very serious hand here.
Financial dealings of these guys, Trump, Cohen, Kushner, they're all on Mueller's table.
Did Trump know all of this and not care? Or did he know none of it because he's incompetent? In other words, is Trump smart enough to be evil?
Hello and welcome to TrumpCast, the show about the man designing the new FBI headquarters in Washington, Donald Trump. I'm Jacob Weisberg. Reportedly, it will have small, windowless offices for Jeff Sessions and Rod Rosenstein, somewhere between the vending machine and the server room. No, seriously, Trump has lots of opinions about the FBI building, which is a genuinely hideous, brutalist-style legacy from the 70s. According to Axios, Trump wants to oversee the project at an excruciating level of detail, the cost per square foot, the materials used, and so on. He's treating it like it's a Trump Organization construction project, one source told them. What other than sheer love of real estate development might motivate this micromanagement? Well, for one thing, Trump's hugely profitable hotel more or less across the street. If the General Services Administration were to go through with its plan to move the FBI to Maryland or Virginia, it could sell the current property to a developer who might build another fancy hotel that would take business away from the Trump International on Pennsylvania Avenue. Brutalist buildings make great hip hotels. It might save the government a lot of money and cost the president, so he's blocked the plan. Given the huge, obvious conflict of interest here, it's just incredible that Trump is sitting in meetings about this project, which a president of the United States shouldn't be involved in anyway. But getting involved in projects he shouldn't go near is what has always defined Trump's real estate business. He's been only too happy to provide a front for the international crime set and lend a hand to dirty money in search of a laundry room. And that's what today's show is about, how Trump partnered with a shady Russian accused of corruption and ties to the Russian mafia to build a tower in Toronto. Joining me to talk about it is Tom Burgess of the Financial Times. But first,
Sarah Huckabee Sanders presents A Guide to Apologizing.
Hello, thanks for having me here today. My name is Sarah Huckabee Sanders. I'm going to talk to you about the art of apologizing. The first rule of apologizing is don't. Why would you do that when you didn't do anything wrong? The second rule of apologizing is if you are forced to approximate an apology, make sure you mention the thing you aren't apologizing for in the non-apology. Sometimes just repeating the thing that people are aching for an apology for satiates them for the time being. Number three, make sure to wrap said apology in an accomplishment sandwich. It can be an open face sandwich where there's just one accomplishment that rests like a slice of bread underneath the apology. It can be a wrap where you start with an accomplishment, you say something akin to an apology in the middle, and then you end with an accomplishment. Or it can be a sandwich that you would create in a panini-like press where you press the issue as not being something that actually went wrong. Number four, distance yourself from that mistake. Don't ever claim it was your mistake, my mistake. Keep it general. The mistake, a mistake, and a mistake, but not that one because it's grammatically incorrect. Number five, screw you, Jim Acosta. Don't look at me like that. That concludes my guide to apologizing. No questions at this time.
And that was Sarah Huckabee Sanders' Guide to Apologizing.
Today's sketch was performed in our Brooklyn studio by Kate James.
Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America N.A., member FDIC.
Hey, it's Ryan Reynolds, and I'm here with Keith, co-star of my upcoming film, If, only in theaters May 17th. Do you want to tell people the big news? All right, I'll do. Sign up now and you'll get unlimited for $15 a month and 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan on us.
MintMobile.com/switch.
Upfront payment of $45 equivalent to $15 per month. Unlimited over 40 gigabytes per month. Face lower speeds. Videos at 480p. Active Mint customers by 531.24 get 6 months of Paramount Plus Essential Plan. Auto renews after 6 months. Offer ends May 31st, 2024. Separate Paramount Plus registration required. Terms and conditions apply if rated PG.
One more thing before we jump into our interview. We're thrilled to announce Slate Day, a live podcast experience produced in connection with the Texas Tribune Festival. Slate Day is at the Capitol Factory in downtown Austin, Texas, on Saturday, September 29th. This is an intimate venue with limited seating, so get your tickets today. Go to slate.com/live for tickets and information. And if you want to make a weekend of it, which I am definitely going to be doing, the Texas Tribune is offering $100 off festival badges to Slate Day ticket holders. We'll have a link on our event page to learn more about the festival. Again, that's slate.com/live. Joining me from across the pond is Tom Burgess. Tom is an investigative reporter at the Financial Times, and he wrote a long read piece for the FT. Since this recording, I want to note that Alex Schneider, whose name you'll hear on the show, has responded to the story, and his response can be read at a link in our notes. Tom, thanks for joining me on Trumpcast today.
A pleasure.
The skyscraper in question is in Toronto. When I was thinking about, if I would have been thinking about where to assign a reporter to do a case study of corruption in Donald Trump's real estate empire, I would not have said Canada was the most likely place. I might have sent you to Panama or Indonesia or something, but Canada's a pretty clean country.
Well, yeah, and apart from anyone particularly interested in the fixtures and fittings and so on of the what was until a couple of years ago the Trump Toronto Tower, the story really has very little to do with Canada. As ever with Trump's real estate developments, the story is about where the money originated. And as we've come to expect, the money originated in the former Soviet Union.
And it's a little like the Trump Soho, a project people here have heard about in that respect, and that a lot of the people involved are Russian. But the building, which was the Trump International Hotel and Tower in Toronto, is in Toronto. It's that building is done now, right? Can we get rooms there? I mean, is it functioning as a hotel?
You can. It has been it's been functioning for a few years now. It was the grand opening, complete with fanfare for the common man and various celebrated ice hockey players, took place in 2012. And it went for 4 years before going bust. as other Trump ventures have. It's called the Adelaide Hotel now, second tallest building in Canada, and you can get rooms there. But I wanted to pick up one other thing you said. You mentioned it's a bit like the Trump Soho, and it is in quite a significant way like the Trump Soho and like a few other pre-major Trump projects, in that it uses this business model that he develops from kind of around the turn of the century, from the time when his serial bankruptcies mean that he can't turn easily to mainstream banks, and he develops this kind of licensing branding model. So and it's around this time that you start to see these big flows of money from Russia and the rest of the former Soviet Union coming through these Trump branded projects. That Soho is a very good example, and we've seen how there's been alleged money laundering through that project. But also the Toronto, and what it does crucially for Trump, and what he said to us when we asked the Trump Organization before we published our story a lot of questions about the origins of the money for the Trump Toronto. What it does for them is they can say, it's not our money, it's not our problem. We are not responsible for vetting the origins of this money. We just license our name. We take a contract to manage the hotel. Yeah, we make millions and millions from this. But they outsource responsibility for the source of the money to other people.
But lots of people in the licensing business, including in the hotel resort development business, are quite careful about who they let use their name, and they don't want it to be tainted by unscrupulous partners or money laundering. I mean, but with Trump, it sounds like basically his name's available to anybody. I mean, did they do any checking? Do you think they've ever said no to anybody who wanted to buy the use of their name?
I and colleagues of mine have been looking for a couple of years at these various Trump projects, and I haven't come across an instance of him saying no. That's not to say there isn't one. I spoke to one person in the New York real estate scene who's done business with the Trump Organization, and the term he chose was willful obliviousness. Willful obliviousness to describe the approach of the Trump Organization. There's been a Tim O'Brien interview in which he spoke to a former executive who said Donald doesn't do due diligence. There does seem to have been this culture within the Trump Organization of caring not a jot for the sources of the money that would build the buildings that would bear his name.
Tom, I gather it's bedtime at your house. Is that your son we hear in the background screaming about Donald Trump?
That's my daughter.
Sorry. Sorry about that. We're very happy to have company. And in this case, the partners were from the world of Russian oligarchs, and the main partner was someone called Alex Schneider. Am I pronouncing the name correctly?
Yeah, I say Schneider, but he's always refused to talk to us. So Schneider is what I'd say. He's born in Russia. He grew up in Toronto, and his central business holdings are in Ukraine.
And he is someone who is allegedly connected to the Russian mob. How did he get connected to Donald Trump? And did Donald Trump, do you think, have any idea, or did he care at all that Mr. Schneider had some very dubious and shady connections?
Well, we should say at the outset that Schneider, through his lawyers, he declined to answer all our questions, declined to be interviewed ahead of publication. Since publication, he's complained about the story. The details of that complaint so far are confidential, but it should be mentioned, and we remain obviously keen to speak to him. You mentioned a connection to the Russian mafia. This goes right back into the origins of Schneider's fortune. His father-in-law at the time was a man called Boris Burstein. He's an extraordinary character. He's a Russian emigre to Canada, like Schneider, but older. And he was able to move with incredible freedom across the Iron Curtain, and he cultivated interests as high as Brezhnev and then onwards through the collapsing final years of the Soviet Union. And he did business. He was one of the few Western businessmen who could operate in the Soviet Union and who knew the terrain as the Soviet Union was collapsing and there were opportunities to be grabbed. And he brought on Schneider as a kind of protege, and then he our understanding is that he helped to set up Schneider in Ukraine. And in Ukraine is when Schneider made it big. Basically, he got hold of an enormous steel mill. And it's that steel mill and a deal surrounding it that is the key to understanding the serious questions about the money that ended up going through the Trump Toronto.
So he sold, Schneider sold that steel mill, right?
Yeah. He sold that steel mill during the construction of the Trump Toronto, and shortly afterwards, he earmarked another $40 million to go into the Trump Toronto. Now, obviously, what we're all looking for in these situations is the sources of money that flows into Trump projects, that flows, in many cases, from the former Soviet Union westwards, seeking the legitimacy of a Western real estate project. In this case, The crucial thing to focus on is money that went in the opposite direction. So what our story reveals is that as part of this sale, to facilitate this sale for $850 million of the steel mill, which is in eastern Ukraine, Zaporizhzhia, it's called, Alex Schneider, the developer of the Trump Toronto, the man who is licensing Trump's name and paying him for it, Schneider authorizes a secret payment of $100 million. $100 million that will flow through BVI companies and Cyprus shell companies and will end up with, as Schneider understood, introducers working for ultimately the Russian government, because it was ultimately the Russian government through intermediaries, through representatives, that was going to buy this steel mill, strategic asset in eastern Ukraine a few years before Russia invaded eastern Ukraine. The point here is that from the documents we got hold of, There are reasons to raise questions and to pose questions about where that $100 million went and whether there's a risk that $100 million ended up enriching Russian officials. If that's what happened, as the various experts that we spoke to, that we ran this all this by, explained, if money that was paid by Alex Schneider, by the developer of the Trump Toronto, through these secret channels, ended up enriching Russian officials, then you've got criminal activity that's producing money that's flowing through Trump Toronto. And that's what opens up the possibility of the Trump Toronto having been used as a money laundering exercise in part.
You're saying because in this scenario, Schneider would have violated whatever the Canadian equivalent is of the Foreign Corrupt Practices Act, which says you can't bribe officials to get business.
And that's right.
Allegedly, of course. But if he essentially paid $100 million as a fee to Russian government officials to do this deal around the steel mill, the deal was that those were, in effect, ill-gotten gains, and those ill-gotten gains were cleaned through this construction project in Toronto.
There's a sequence of events that works like that, yeah. It's not to say that Schneider knew exactly where this $100 million was going. There are differing versions, differing accounts, disputed accounts of where the $100 million went. But there's no question that Schneider signed off on a $100 million payment. Remember, $100 million out of $850 million deal price. So more than 10% of the price of a deal going in a secret commission payment to an introducer, is the term Schneider used, who he knew to be operating on behalf of the interests of the Russian state.
How much did Donald Trump get paid to let this guy use his name?
Well, all we know about that, because obviously the Trump Organization is privately held, is what we can piece together from the financial disclosures of candidate and President Trump. So it only goes back to 2014. And the initial, this kind of genesis of the Trump Toronto is way back in sort of 2002-03. So in the intervening years, we don't know how much he was paid, but we know that between 2014 and 2017, which is over the period that the project finally goes broke, he made about $4 million.
Which is not very much, it seems, in the scale of the project. Of course, he's not doing very much. Essentially, he's selling his name.
Yeah, it's a kind of, the project's about $400 million US dollars. And that, remember, is that $4 million is what we see at the very end of the project. Whether there are lump sums earlier, whether there are annual amounts earlier, around the time that it's being completed, we don't know. It could be much more. The Trump Organization won't say. As you say, it's not very much in terms of the scale of the project. But if you think that the Trump Organization has zero risk here, this is the sort of genius, I suppose, of this Trump licensing model, is that he can say, I put up no capital in almost all cases. I take no business risk, no financial risk. I ask no questions about where the money came from. And I make millions and millions of dollars. So, yeah, it's a small amount, but it's a large amount for doing that.
He just shows up for the groundbreaking in a suit and tie and smiles for the camera, and that's about it. But What responsibility does Trump or the Trump Organization have when entering these kinds of deals for the use of his name? What's his legal responsibility? And what would you say is commonly understood as the ethical responsibility in that kind of situation? I mean, imagine it weren't Trump. Imagine it were the Four Seasons or some other hotel chain that, you know, that thinks about who it partners with and who it lets use its name.
Yeah, exactly. So this is something I've been talking to as many lawyers and experts on this as I can about. It was put to me quite well by one person as there's a scale, there's a range of responsibilities. So if you are HSBC and someone comes to you with a suitcase with $50 million in it, you are obviously obliged to ask questions. And if you fail to do that, the law will look very harshly upon you in most countries and certainly most Western countries. If you are a dentist and someone walks in off the street and pays $30 for to have their tooth crowned, the fact that you didn't establish that $30 came from a robbery 3 months earlier, it is unlikely to be held against you. So the question is, on scale from dentist to HSBC, where does Trump sit? And it's clearly more towards the HSBC end, but we've got to remember within the US, there are huge loopholes for the obligations on real estate developers. This is why American real estate is possibly, arguably, the world's most favorite asset for money laundering.
It sounds like, Tom, the legal responsibility, legal liability is not very great unless someone actually came to Trump and said, these are ill-gotten gains from a criminal transaction done by this oligarch. Unless Trump actually knew that, if he merely knew that this guy was a shady character who wanted to buy his name and said, I don't want to know anymore, la, 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 don't tell me anything. In that case, he's legally fine under Canadian law and U.S. law, right?
As I understand it, yes, that's the case. I think, though, there's 2 points to make there. One is, the more we learn, for instance, about the dirt-gathering meeting that Donald Jr. went to and the ever-stronger suggestions that Donald Trump knew about that meeting and organized a response to it. So I think we should be wary of assuming the absence of knowledge in all cases. It could be that Donald Trump Sr. actually has a closer hold and a deeper understanding of the details of his political and business activities than maybe we think. And secondly, and I think this is an important point and one we try to make in the piece, is about an alignment of interests and a broader way of understanding what Donald Trump means as president, what it means to have a US president who, more than any other official to have reached similarly high office in the West, is deeply, deeply entwined with these networks of often anonymous offshore financial interests linked back to the former Soviet Union. We know that these networks have penetrated politics. We know that they've penetrated British politics. We know that there are oligarchs who've sidled up to major figures in Western countries. But to have a president whose business interests through this licensing model is so enmeshed with that world, what does that mean? And I think when you look through that prism at the way Trump makes his decisions, whether it's on Ukraine or on Russian sanctions, foreign policy questions, or even on just the notion of conflict of interest, that central notion to democracy, you start to understand it more clearly when you think of a man who moves in this world where personal enrichment and political power, there is no division between those two things in many cases.
Let's talk a little more specifically about Ukraine. The name Paul Manafort has to be coming up here in any time now. I mean, Paul Manafort was working on the side of Russian interests in Ukraine. And in particular, the big Russian interest became defending the occupation of Crimea, which, amazingly enough, was this one point on which the Republican platform in 2016 changed. And this has never been decisively proven that this was connected. But meanwhile, Trump, seemingly coming from another angle, has this partner who's just made $850 million selling a steel, enormous steel mill in eastern Ukraine, apparently having paid a nice finder's fee or something to the Russians. I mean, are these things all connected or are they merely coincidences?
Often connected, I would say. Let me give you another example from our story. This intermediary, this fixer that the $100 million purportedly goes to, is a man called Igor Bakai. So Bakai, just to give you a quick story, he is a kind of wheeler-dealer businessman from the most Wild West days in Ukraine. So I think some would say that Ukraine was possibly even more frenzied than Russia in the competition to capture its riches, you know, in the 90s after the end of the Soviet Union. And Bakai is one of these guys who's generally known as sort of mid-level trader, pops up as Mr. Gas in Ukraine. So he's an absolutely crucial intermediary in the gas trade from Central Asia and Russia through Ukraine into Europe. One of the key strategic levers that Putin develops to pressure Russia's neighbors, the former Soviet republics, and beyond that, the European Union. Bakai's in the middle of all this. He's involved, it's been alleged but never proven, he's involved in diverting gas revenues to the political purposes of his protectors, of his masters. And that is generally the group of pro-Russian politicians that have largely held power in Ukraine since independence, punctuated by the occasional revolution. Most recently, the Maidan, but before that, 2004, the Orange Revolution. After the end of the Orange Revolution, which came after President Kuchma's time, Bakai fled the country. He'd been working as a senior figure, first in the gas business, then in the presidential administration. He was given, when he arrived in Moscow, he was given Russian citizenship, and he set up as a business fixer. And he does various deals, we're beginning to understand, that advance Russian business interests in eastern Ukraine as a kind of second thread of Russian control, basically, over Ukraine alongside its political dealings. And Bakai emerges as a kind of go-to guy for deals that the Kremlin wants done in Ukraine. And what then should he pop up in but Alex Schneider's sale of his steel mill, which generates, as we've said, large amounts of money, hundreds of millions of dollars for Schneider shortly before he's putting another $40 million through the Trump Toronto. You ask if it's coincidence or conspiracy. I think a bit of both. But I think the point is that if we step back from it, you made a similar point on one of your previous episodes. You step back from this. If this wasn't Trump, if this was some other president, and we were discovering the extent to which his business interests were enmeshed with this kind of activity of geopolitics, enormous secret payments, Russian meddling, all fusing, that would be astonishing, and that would shake the foundations of a presidency. But in this extraordinary case, it's just another example.
Well, amazingly, I mean, as you, this story shows, this deal for the Trump Tower Toronto was sleazy in so many different ways. But that deal is one of scores of deals like it, many of them in places like former Soviet Georgia and
Azerbaijan,
right? Any one of these could be in any normal administration be an enormous scandal. The mind boggles. You don't know where to start, but you can't start because there's no information that's been made public, because Trump hasn't engaged in even the most ordinary and routine forms of disclosure about his business interests. We don't know how this is influencing how the people he's involved with here and the interests he has have influenced and continue to influence the policy decisions he's making and the things he's saying. And it's overwhelming. I mean, you spent 10 months sorting out as best you could this one deal, and you've got 20 more to do.
Well, I think there is one way of coming at it, which is the other way around. Not to start with Trump. So obviously, this has happened, and the Trump presidency is unfolding before our eyes, but it was clearly not an inevitability. But the bigger trend is the huge rise in the last 30-odd years of kleptocracies around the world and globalized corruption. Before I was looking at Trump and on the investigations team for the FT in London, I was a correspondent in Africa for years. And I'm very used to seeing this kind of politics. I lived in Nigeria for a couple of years, and this is just how politics works. It's a game of capturing power for the purposes of self-enrichment of you and your circle. And that's accepted. That's how it works, obviously with a facade around the front, but that's the deal. And Russian politics works very, very similarly. And this kind of government has been expanding and has been projecting its influence into the West through lobbyists and through the oil deals and so on. That's created this enormous tide of money that's been flowing. It's been looking for places to hide and looking for places to become legitimate. And US real estate, as I was saying earlier, is a classic repository for that. Now, that's not to put someone like Alex Schneider in that same category. The developers of the Trump Toronto are businessmen who've lived in Toronto for many, many years, but who are also connected through their operations to Ukraine, to Russia, to some of the places where this kind of kleptocratic rule is deeply entrenched. And to operate in those places and not be sucked into this kind of klepto geopolitics is incredibly difficult.
But aren't we just scratching the surface of the Trump organization's sleazy involvement all over the world? I mean, every one of its projects has connections like this. I mean, it just makes me think it's going to be the work of decades. I mean, decades after Trump is out of office and probably long dead, we're going to be figuring out the full story of what they were up to.
I think that's probably true, and that's why I suppose it's important to keep digging into these questions of his business deals before he became president. But and we allude to this in the story. One of the really troubling things is the emergence of this kind of politics riddled with conflict of interest in the Trump White House. You've covered it on many of your episodes, but the proliferation of conflicts of interest at the EPA or wherever it may be is absolutely remarkable. And we've had these stories denied by Ukraine and Trump. But these stories, for instance, about like kind of pay-for-play payments going through Michael Cohen, it's those kind of things that set off alarm bells about whether this kind of politics, Russian, Nigerian, Kazakh politics, is taking hold in Washington, which I think would have been astonishing to anyone if you'd suggested it was going to happen 5 years ago, the usual Washington corruption standards notwithstanding.
Well, it's a dirty story and a very, very good one. Tom, thanks for joining me on the show. I've been speaking to Tom Burgess of the Financial Times.
It's been a real pleasure. Thank you for having me.
That's it for today's show, but I want to remind listeners once again to sign up for Slate Plus at slate.com/TrumpCastPlus so you don't miss any episodes of TrumpCast. Also, come watch us at the Texas Tribune Festival. You can find tickets at slate.com/live. And one more request, follow us on Twitter at RealTrumpCast. It's the best way to interact with us and keep up with the show. TrumpCast is produced by Jason DeLeon. Our sketch today was performed by Kate James as Sarah Huckabee Sanders. Oh my God, is that a good impression? I'm Jacob Weisberg. Thanks again for listening to Trumpcast.
Hi, I'm Josh Levine. My podcast, The Queen, tells the story of Linda Taylor. She was a con artist, a kidnapper, and maybe even a murderer. She was also given the title The Welfare Queen, and her story was used by Ronald Reagan to justify slashing aid to the poor. Now, it's time to hear her real story. Over the course of 4 episodes, you'll find out what was done to Linda Taylor, what she did to others, and what was done in her name.
The great lesson of this for me is that people will come to their own conclusions based on what their prejudices are.
Subscribe to The Queen on Apple Podcasts or wherever you're listening right now.